This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, talking about last night's historic election results. We turn now to Congress. Jeff Bennett joins me. He is Time Warner Cable News Washington reporter. Jeff, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Good to be with you.
Also with us is Michael Bitzer, political scientist from Catawba College. He joins us from sister station WFAE in Charlotte. Hello, Michael Bitzer.
Hello.
Let's see, North Carolina. Let's talk about the Congress and both the Senate and the House. Jeff Bennett, it was expected to be a pretty good night for Democrats, at least in the Senate. Didn't turn out that way.
The split now is 47 Democrats. They picked up one seat and 51 Republicans. Republicans lost a seat. So Republicans keep control of the Senate. And in the House, Democrats now have 193 seats. And Republicans have 239. They only needed 218 seats to keep control. So, again, Donald Trump is elected president with a Republican Congress there beside him.
I think the polls seemed to be right about was, even though it showed a close race between Richard Burr and his challenger, Deborah Ross, Richard Burr was polling ahead of Deborah Ross and sure enough won. And here he is last night at giving a victory speech.
Our first grandchild arrived earlier this year. And we celebrate tonight with hope of her future and the future of your grandchildren. That's why I ran again this year, to make sure she and all of your grandchildren have the unlimited opportunities and a safer world in which to live.
And as Senator Richard Burr, President Barack Obama is giving a talk now at the White House, and we want to take you to that live, and then we will return. Here is President Barack Obama.
We could hit the ground running. And one thing you realize quickly in this job is that the presidency and the vice presidency is bigger than any of us. So I have instructed my team to follow the example that President Bush's team set 8 years ago and work as hard as we can to make sure that this is a successful transition for the president-elect. Because we are now all rooting for his success in uniting and leading the country. The peaceful transition of power is one of the hallmarks of our democracy. And over the next few months, we are going to show that to the world. I also had a chance last night to speak with Secretary Clinton, and I just had a chance to hear her remarks. I could not be prouder of her. She has lived an extraordinary life of public service. She was a great First Lady. She was an outstanding senator for the state of New York. And she could not have been a better Secretary of State. I'm proud of her. A lot of Americans look up to her. Her candidacy and nomination was historic and sends a message to our daughters all across the country that they can achieve at the highest levels of politics. And I'm absolutely confident that she and President Clinton will continue to do great work for people here in the United States and all around the world. Now, everybody is sad when their side loses an election. But the day after, we have to remember that we're actually all on one team. This is an intramural scrimmage. We're not Democrats first. We're not Republicans first. We are Americans first. We're patriots first. We all want what's best for this country. That's what I heard in Mr. Trump's remarks last night. That's what I heard when I spoke to him directly. And I was heartened by that. That's what the country needs. A sense of unity, a sense of inclusion, a respect for our institutions, our way of life, rule of law, and a respect for each other. I hope that he maintains that spirit throughout this transition, and I certainly hope that's how his presidency has a chance to begin. I also told my team today to keep their heads up, because the remarkable work that they have done day in, day out, often without a lot of fanfare, often with a lot of attention, work in agencies, work in obscure areas of policy that make government run better and make it more responsive and make it more efficient and make it more service friendly so that it's actually helping more people. That remarkable work has left the next president with a stronger, better country than the one that existed 8 years ago. So win or lose in this election, that was always our mission. That was our mission from day one. And everyone on my team should be extraordinarily proud of everything that they have done. And so should all the Americans that I've had a chance to meet all across this country, who do the hard work of building on that progress every single day. Teachers in schools, doctors in an ER clinic, small businesses putting their all into starting something up, making sure they're treating their employees well. All the important work that's done by moms and dads and families and congregations in every state. The work of perfecting this union. So this was a long and hard-fought campaign. A lot of our fellow Americans are exultant today. A lot of Americans are less so. But that's the nature of campaigns. That's the nature of democracy. It is hard and sometimes contentious and noisy. It's not always inspiring. But to the young people who got into politics for the first time and may be disappointed by the results, I just want you to know you have to stay encouraged. Don't get cynical. Don't ever think you can't make a difference. As Secretary Clinton said this morning, fighting for what is right is worth it. Sometimes you lose an argument. Sometimes you lose an election. You know, the path that this country has taken has never been a straight line. We zig and zag, and sometimes we move in ways that some people think is forward and others think is moving back. And that's okay. I've lost elections before. Joe hasn't, but, you know. So I've been sort of sharing.
Remember, you beat me badly.
That's the way politics works sometimes. We try really hard to persuade people that we're right. And then people vote. And then if we lose, we learn from our mistakes, we do some reflection, we lick our wounds, we brush ourselves off, we get back in the arena, we go at it, we try even harder the next time. The point, though, is that we all go forward with a presumption of good faith in our fellow citizens. Because that presumption of good faith is essential to a vibrant and functioning democracy. That's how this country has moved forward for 240 years. That's how we've pushed boundaries and promoted freedom around the world. That's how we've expanded the rights of our founding to reach all of our citizens. It's how we have come this far. And that's why I'm confident that this incredible journey that we're on as Americans will go on. And I'm looking forward to doing everything that I can to make sure that the next president is successful in that. I've said before, I think of this job as being a relay runner. You take the baton, you run your best race, and hopefully by the time you hand it off, you're a little further ahead. You've made a little progress. And I can say that we've done that, and I want to make sure that handoff is well executed because ultimately we're all on the same team. All right? Thank you very much, everybody.
President Barack Obama, in the aftermath of Donald Trump's victory last night, assuring voters and the American public that he will work closely with Donald Trump saying that all of us in America are rooting for his success, working closely with his team for a smooth transition as he makes his way to the White House and President Obama makes his way out. I'm Frank Stacio on the State of Things, and with me today to talk about the aftermath of the election, Jeff Bennett, Time Warner Cable News Washington reporter. I'm also talking with Kerry Haney, welcoming him to our program. He's a political science professor at Duke University. Kerry Haney, welcome. Good to have you. And Susan Roberts joins me now, a professor of political science at Davidson College, is joining us from WDAV at Davidson. Hello, Susan Roberts. And still with me is Michael Bitzer. Michael Bitzer, who is a professor of political science at Catawba College. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit, Jeff Bennett. I want to go back to you, Washington reporter for Time Warner Cable News. You know, you heard the president talking about a relay and talking about, look, this is just politics. You win some, you lose some. But this is an extraordinary race. This is not a normal race. And things in Washington are not very normal in terms of the relationship between Donald Trump and even his own party. How's it going to look when he shows up and tries to preside over the Capitol?
Well, it's extraordinary in the sense that the incoming president is the one who led the charge against the current president in undermining his legitimacy, suggesting that he was not born in this country. I've done some reporting on this transition, and I'll tell you that Hillary Clinton's transition team was far ahead of Donald Trump's transition team up until the point of last night where she lost the race. So you heard President Obama talk about this smooth handoff. There's going to be a lot of last-minute work, very hurried and harried work in the 70-plus days between now and the inauguration to make sure that this handoff is smooth and, frankly, that there's not some sort of major national security catastrophe if there are not people and procedures in place to prevent that from happening.
And during the race, the president made the extraordinary statement in politics, in a political campaign, not that he didn't agree with Donald Trump, but that he was unfit for office. So this is an extraordinary transition. Michael Bitzer, let's come back to North Carolina and talk a little bit about the turnout here in this state in North Carolina. Tell us more about the turnout and sort of overall how it compared to 2012 and who voted and who didn't.
Right. Well, in 2012, we had 4.5 million ballots cast. That was out of 6.6 million registered voters. That was about 68% turnout among the registered voters. This year, we went up 4.7 million out of 6.8 million registered voters. But again, we had a turnout rate of 68%. What was interesting to me was the number of ballots that came in before Election Day. We had well over 3 million absentee ballots either by mail or in person coming in. And among that 3 million plus absentee ballots, a quarter, one out of every four, were from registered unaffiliated voters. And they are 30% of the registered voter pool. And that is the new dynamic that is really making North Carolina much harder to try and decipher and to see the patterns of where they are going and how they are voting. And indeed, in the exit polls, independents were just as many as Republicans were. Democrats were slightly ahead, but this is a whole new dynamic, and those independents went to Donald Trump in North Carolina.
Much was made early in this race, or as the race progressed and getting closer to Election Day, Kerry Haney, of the African-American vote, which seemed to be in early voting down compared to 2012. What do you make of that?
Frank, it was from the entire start of this general campaign, the lack of enthusiasm among African-Americans was clear and visible. One marker for me is my barbershop. And I would go to the barbershop, I remember 4 years ago and 8 years ago, and in September and August, there were Obama signs all over the place and there was some buzz. I was in the barbershop 3 weeks before the election, still no Hillary sign in my barbershop. And to me, that was an indication of a lack of enthusiasm out there among African-Americans for the Clinton campaign. And in part because I think the campaign didn't reach out in the same ways that the Obama team did.
Yeah, and to talk more about that, whether or not it was the candidate herself or the campaign that you think maybe fell short, what else might have been, what accounted for, what else would account for a lack of enthusiasm in a race where the two candidates were very, very clearly defined and very, very different?
You know, one of the things that's long been said about the Democrats and the black vote is that the Democratic Party takes for granted the black vote. And I think that may be some of what's at work here. You may have advantages with that vote, but if you don't ask for it and you don't work for it, you may not get it. And that may be, in the final analysis, what happened here.
Susan Roberts, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you.
This is the first presidential election without some mandates of the Voting Rights Act. Did that make any difference, do you think, in North Carolina?
Well, I think that's going to be difficult to really disaggregate. I think there were questions about what was going to happen in the eastern part of the state, caging, purging. But one thing that we don't really understand is whether or not there was the impression. I don't think we're going to find voter intimidation, but we may find with interviews, there's no way to really quantify it, that voters felt as if, I don't know if I have the right identification. Ari Berman of The Nation really has made over a third of his articles over the last, say, 3 or 4 years have been about North Carolina as the epicenter, so to speak, and he didn't use those words, of voting rights biases in the country. He called North Carolina the new Selma, and I think that there's been a lot of attention. Now, what are we going to find when we look through the votes, say, that Pat McCrory is? Are we going to find any irregularities? I don't think so, but I think there was the impression. But we'll never know about whether or not this was any sort of suppression. There are all kinds of mechanical errors that can go on, and I think that's what part of what happened in Durham. But I don't think we can find any instances of outright fraud. There's always, you know, there's always that anecdote, but I don't know that there'll be any really accounting for fraud in this election. I could be wrong.
Michael Bitzer, what do you make of the vote in general and in terms of the way it turned out? The polls tended to show North Carolina moving toward Hillary Clinton toward the end of this cycle, and it certainly didn't turn out that way. I guess you talked a little bit about it. Independent voters were a big part of that.
Yeah.
What else do you think accounts for that?
Well, I think with the polls, you have to remember that there's this thing called a margin of error. And whenever we see the numbers, and we saw the numbers so tight here in North Carolina, it was literally a coin toss. But you have to take that margin of error and say, well, it could be one way by a certain set of numbers, or it could be another way by another set of numbers. And I think what the pollsters were trying to do was to try and figure out what the dynamics and what the composition of the electorate would look like, and then base that and run their numbers off of that. What we're seeing is a slightly different electorate from 2012. What we saw was African-American voters made up 23% of the entire electorate. This year, they were 19%. So what Kerry was talking about in terms of the lack of enthusiasm, yeah, that small drop could have significant changes. And what I think also is happening is the dynamics within that electorate is also very different, particularly among North Carolina white working class voters. They were at times for Barack Obama, but I think Trump's message spoke to them, and they shifted their allegiance. And that is something that the dynamics can't necessarily always catch in the polling. We just have to wait until the votes come in and see what the dynamics, particularly in exit polls, show us.
Kerry Haney?
Yeah, another surprise in these returns is the women vote, that Hillary Clinton didn't move the needle in terms of support for the Democratic candidate. I mean, I think she got just about what Barack Obama did, maybe a little less. And I found that surprising that she was not able to attract women to her campaign.
Susan Roberts, what do you make of that?
Well, I think that the women's vote is not a monolith, and I don't think that straight appeals to reproductive rights are going to be the things that really will deliver that vote. I think she talked in terms of education, freedom of education. I think she talked a lot in terms of children and families. And I do think there was the concern about the rhetoric on the part of Donald Trump for women. But I think you saw at the end when they were interviewing women for Trump in North Carolina, Mark Meadows' wife was part of that. They didn't care about the messenger. They cared about the message. And I think that they wanted for women to be looked at as women that cared about the future of this country and not just about the future of their family or whether or not they were going to have whether they were going to have a future in terms of getting a better job. I do think, however, I want to, with what Kerry said, is that the African-American millennials, didn't want to be taken for granted. And Trump echoed that message that the Democratic Party has taken you for granted. And I think that really underscored a lot of the dynamics with that constituency and maybe with women as well.
Our breakdown of election 2016 continues on the State of Things, talking to Susan Roberts at Davidson College, Michael Bitzer at Catawba College, Carrie Haney at Duke, Jeff Bennett, Washington reporter for Time Warner Cable News. Our conversation will continue in a moment. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, continuing our 2016 election coverage, looking at what the results mean moving forward. Current numbers show that Hillary Clinton actually won the popular vote. Donald Trump secured the Electoral College, so he is the leader. He will nominate the next Supreme Court justice. He determines the country's next steps on health care, immigration, national defense. Still with us to talk about this are professors of political science, Susan Roberts and Michael Bitzer, and joining us now is the political junkie, Ken Rudin. Hello, Ken.
Hello, Frank.
Ken, let me ask you about this. This is a fascinating election. As we said, Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. It was something like 200,000 more votes at this moment. And I'm thinking about this as a watershed election. And I go back to 1980, another watershed election. In that election, Ronald Reagan, landslide victory, comes in with a mandate. The House is in the hands of the Democrats. And Tip O'Neill seems to understand that something has changed. And he, you know, immediately starts to change the way the Democrats do business. I'm wondering what happens in this race so close with the popular vote going to the losing candidate. What happens in Congress and the relationship between Trump and Congress?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know if it's a great analogy, only because, of course, as you point out, Trump does have a Republican House and a Senate now. Reagan had the Senate when he won in 1980, not the House. And I also feel that Tip O'Neill basically had no choice. He was almost like steamrolled by Reagan and conservative Democrats within his own party. So that led to the huge tax cuts and things like that that Tip O'Neill probably wouldn't like. But you know, the interesting thing here is that Reagan didn't run against his own party
right.
in 1980. He ran with Republicans everywhere.
Right.
That's not the case with Donald Trump in this election. He attacked his own Speaker of the House. He attacked former presidential nominees of his own party. He ran against many of the John McCains and the Jeff Flakes and the Kelly Ayotts, calling them losers. So right now, not only does he have to work with the Democrats to get things done, but he's going to have to mend relations with the Republicans. And as nice as Paul Ryan was this morning with his magnanimous comments about Trump, I think that's going to be a really tough sailing.
Well, not only in the personal dynamic and all the things he said about them, but what is the mandate? And if the mandate is we really don't like organized Republicans or organized politicians, you know, sort of how do you take that on board? What do you make of that if you're what it seems to be that Americans rejected at the polls in voting for Donald Trump? How do you take that as a member of Congress?
Well, it's hard to say this is a mandate because you had two very flawed candidates, with extreme unfavorables in the polls, the highest in polling history. But at the same time, obviously, if you look at the results, and we're still trying to dig through them and what they meant, there was a dissatisfaction out there. Maybe it started with the Tea Party in 2009, but there were changes made to this country that a lot of people, mostly white people, were not ready to accept. And that includes, you know, the Affordable Care Act and same-sex marriage and just things in the social fabric of the country that people were not ready for. So I think people, there was just a fed up, like what about my jobs being shipped overseas? What about a feckless foreign policy? What about a porous border? Whether those are real issues or manufactured issues, a lot of voters believed it, and Donald Trump is now going to have to deliver on those.
Well, Michael Bitzer and Susan Roberts, let me ask you both. I'll start with you, Michael Bitzer. How you would assess that? If there's a mandate, what is the message here, and how does Congress respond to that?
I think the mandate, if you look in the exit poll, is found very clearly in one key question. The question was, what is your feeling about the federal government? And 70% of respondents in the national poll said they were either dissatisfied or angry at the federal government. And guess who won the vast majority of that support? Donald Trump. So if there is any mandate that Donald Trump is coming into his presidency with, it is to shake the system up. The problem is he has a Congress, and a particularly a Republican-controlled Congress, that doesn't necessarily want to shake the system up as much as his base wants them to shake it up. So it will be a fascinating case study, even though there is unified party government, to watch what happens between President Trump and particularly Speaker Ryan, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, how they can work together to achieve goals that they both want to achieve, but have very different visions, perhaps, of how to go about achieving that.
Susan Roberts?
Well, I think when I think back to the Republican convention and Trump came out and said, I alone can do it, I thought the subtext was, I can do it alone. And I think that's what he's going to have to deal with when he gets to working with Congress. The one thing that he will have perfect unanimity with is that he will support Supreme Court justices, and the Republicans will go right along with him. And they were ones that he said there will be, quote unquote, great legal minds. One of the things that's maybe not policy-oriented, but Donald Trump kept calling everyone in Washington and all of his candidates or his adversaries stupid. The people in Washington are stupid. And that wasn't just to the president. And I think that's really going to be the challenge, is to get the respect of Congress, because I don't think that letting Trump be Trump is necessarily the way to deal with the new Congress. That may have gotten him in the election, but it's no way to govern.
Well, let's talk about those. Let's take some of the issues that he'll be facing very quickly. Ken Rudin, for instance, that Supreme Court vacancy, that's his to name, right? I mean, it's Donald Trump, so he may be working closely with Congress on that, but he's the guy who makes the choice, right?
He is, and obviously I think he's going to be listening to more people than he did. Remember during the campaign, he says, you know, I get most of my information from the Sunday talk shows and not from the, and I know more than the generals. I think he's going to listen to far more people than he indicated he was during the campaign. And I think that includes Supreme Court nominees as well. Now, there's no guarantee that the Senate there's no guarantee that the Democrats won't filibuster the Supreme Court nomination the way the Republicans did with Merrick Garland. But basically, I mean, you know, he does have, especially with a new president, and for all the ill will that was gone on during this campaign, there is still a sense of goodwill with those who are trying to make the new presidency, the new administration, be successful.
Also, immigration. Trump has repeatedly talked against the deferred action for childhood arrivals. I mean, do you expect early action on that?
That's a good question. I mean, when the Republicans controlled everything under George W. Bush, they were desperately trying to work out an immigration policy but the differences between the Chamber of Commerce wing of the Republican Party and the more nativist wing, the anti-immigration wing of the party, just couldn't get anything done. And same with repealing Obamacare. I mean, you know, the Tea Party Republicans have been talking about that since they took over the House. They got rid of Boehner, and they're giving Paul Ryan headaches because, well, we were elected to get rid of it. Why do we still have Obamacare? We may not have it after this election, and perhaps Donald Trump could either work with Congress or he could emulate President Obama, who did a lot of executive actions to get what he wanted. He didn't get everything accomplished, but maybe Donald Trump does that process as well.
Let's talk more about that rift between the Chamber of Commerce wing and the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party. Donald Trump has talked repeatedly about bringing jobs back, and one of the ways he's going to do that is to impose taxes on companies that manufacture abroad and bring their goods into this country. That is not a Chamber of Commerce agenda item, and I wonder if this is something that's going to be, sort of at the top of the list, or something that was just part of the campaign?
I suspect the latter. I suspect that there's no way. I think the Republicans were just aghast when they heard that. Many Republicans who refused to back Trump during his campaign said his trade and tax policies were among the top reasons why that was the case. And I suspect that a lot of the rhetoric you saw during the campaign may not be implemented as policy.
Michael Bitzer, let me ask you, and Susan Roberts, but let me start with you on this one, Susan Roberts. Question of rhetoric and kind of where we go from here. A lot of talk in the last few hours about healing the nation, coming together, healing the wounds after a long campaign. The rhetoric in this campaign was severe, and there was a certain amount of permission given in this campaign for some vitriolic and, in fact, dangerous language that we haven't heard in campaigns for a long time. What do you expect will happen in the national debate? Do you think things will actually calm down now that Donald Trump is president, or has he given permission for the American public to speak in ways that it dared not before? Susan?
Well, I think he's given permission for the American public to talk almost any way they want. The language that was used when they use language in the debates that I will not bring up an innuendo to talk in my presidency class, that's a real low. I think also the incivility that we show one another. There's also this antipathy. The Pew Research Center said that most Americans, I think it's over 60% on either side, see the other party as a threat. You know, when we look to see some of the things that Trump has said in terms of having a revolution, and especially how can we work for unity, and I mean this in all sincerity, when he said when he's elected day one, he's going to appoint a special prosecutor and try to put Hillary Clinton in jail, that doesn't bode well for any kind of unity or healing. Now, that may have just been campaign rhetoric, but what you say matters. And sometimes with the presidency, you have to look at the rhetoric. You can't get There's no sunshine. You can't go into the congressional Senate hearings and see what's going on. Or you have to look at what the president says or what the spokesperson says. And so the level of political rhetoric, and incivility, I don't think you can put the genie back in the bottle. And I sure hope I'm wrong.
Michael Bitzer?
I would completely agree with everything Susan said. The only thing that I would add is that it's not just the candidates and it's not just our elected officials that are spewing out the heated rhetoric. It is us, because we have sorted ourselves. Average voters are tending to be more and more in like-minded communities. We only talk with like-minded individuals. And when we meet somebody from the opposite political end of the spectrum, we can't interact with them without it breaking down oftentimes into they don't know what they're talking about. They just don't get it. And I'm afraid that if this environment continues, there really isn't anybody who could bring the two sides together to necessarily have the kind of civil discussions and ultimately compromise about major policy issues. So, you know, the incivility is certainly there. It would take a monumental amount of work, I think, for Donald Trump to bring any kind of Democrats along. If you look at the exit polls, he got less than 10% of Democrats supporting him. Hillary Clinton got less than 10% of Republicans supporting her. The two sides, we are just in tribes, and we don't talk to each other, and that's part of the issue moving forward.
Well, I wonder if that's just a matter of manners and habit and being in silos because of social media and anything else that's allowed us to not talk with people who disagree, or if we simply don't agree on the fundamentals. If you think that improving public education, we can debate how we could improve public education. You're on this side, I'm on that side, but we all agree public education is something we need to make better. We just disagree on how. The fundamental disagreement here is whether or not to have public education. Is there, and that's just one example, but I guess my bigger question to you, Michael and Susan, is do we even agree on the same goals in order to have a common common conversation?
No, we don't. From my perspective, we don't. And it's not just about policy issues. It's not just about politics. It is about that we have sorted ourselves into very segregated communities. So we only interact with people that confirm what we already know. And we only listen to media sources that confirm what we already know. We are becoming more and more predisposed to our political perspectives, and it is creating this gulf that is becoming wider and wider each election cycle.
Susan Roberts?
Well, I think you alluded to it. It's part of it is the social media. I've had many people say, well, I had someone unfriend me on Facebook because of what I said about presidential politics. When you look at Twitter, 140 characters, that's much more reaction than reflection. And I think it creates a lot of ill will. And I think if you look at certain programs, let's say education, where you've got Margaret Spelling and what she wants to do with higher education in terms of cuts to the program that came along with the governor, we can't even say education, even though we all think it's a goal, the Common Core. They're very complex approaches to these problems, and I don't know that we're willing to navigate the hard choices that government is going to have to make. Look at the environment, very fraught with all sorts of regulations. I just think it's going to be a long, hard fight, and I don't think we can do it without some healing. And I sure hope Donald Trump means that, but I don't think that what he's done with his campaign, does not translate into a good governing strategy, and that's what has to happen.
Ken Rudin, you lived in Washington long enough to remember a basketball player named Manute Bol. He was a guy who was brought in, a very tall guy who was not really a basketball player, but he played for the Washington basketball team, and he wasn't really an athlete, but he played well, and he was like 7'9".
He was like
9 feet tall, and but he wasn't an athlete, and it was an incredible thing to watch those games because trained athletes would try to stop him and couldn't because they expected moves to go in a certain way. They know how to be with athletes, and this guy just wasn't one. And I make the analogy to Donald Trump only in that. And he was effective, actually an effective guy. But he's not a trained politician. He doesn't know the way Washington works. And I just wonder about a guy who, you know, doesn't know the moves working with Congress and what that's like. And if you've had any experience with that.
Well, you know, something, a good example is Jimmy Carter in 1976, who was, of course, elected as an anti-Watergate outsider.
Yeah, but he was a governor.
Had trouble with his own party right. When he came into office. His fights with Tip O'Neill and Ted Kennedy were legendary. And then there's something to be said about Donald Trump. But Donald Trump didn't have – I've never seen a candidate who had disdain for civility as Donald Trump had. And I was listening to what Michael was saying, that so many people don't talk to the other side, and that's what's wrong with this country, and I agree with Michael. But at the same time, the other side in many of these conversations have been white nationalists, the alt-right groups that have been in the shadows forever, and suddenly have gotten legitimacy because their candidate won. So, you know, you talk about what Donald Trump needs to do to get things done, and obviously work with a Congress that he has abused during the campaign. But I also think of those other fringe groups who have come out of the woodwork, who just feel emboldened and feel that that you know their way was the winning way. And let's see what the next 4 years are going to look like.
Well, let's see what the next 4 years are going to look like, and we will spend the next 4 years on this program and beyond. But for now, I want to say goodbye to you, Ken Rudin. Thank you so much.
First time I've ever talked about Manute Bol.
On the show, Michael Bitzer, a professor of political science. We'll have a link to Manute Bol at our website. There's a song about him, too. Michael Bitzer, professor of political science at Catawba College, joined us from WFAE. Thank you, Michael.
My pleasure.
Susan Roberts, professor of political science at Davidson College. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton-Ormond, Katie Barron, and Laura Pelliser. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf, WNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.